Hello, dear listener, and welcome back to Flight Through Entirety, the only Doctor Who podcast that firmly believes we'd have a much better show if every cliffhanger was resolved by Sylvia Noble swinging an axe. I'm Nathan.
I'm James.
I'm Peter.
And I'm Adam.
Well, we've been stuck in this Peugeot 307 for a week now, and it's starting to smell like an Australian summer in here. The air's unbreathable, the visibility's non-existent, and we're all going to suffocate from the fumes. Welcome to the poisoned sky. It was really, really resonant watching it this time. And this episode perhaps strives to be about something.
Yes.
Yeah. And it's about cars and emissions. So we were told last week that Atmos causes cars to have zero carbon emissions.
Which is exciting.
Yeah, apparently. Yeah, yeah. Well, that'd be a thing.
Yeah.
So, you know, the original suggestion was that Atmos was originally supposed to be a chimney.
Oh, yeah, I saw that.
A chimney attachment.
That would be great. Cars with chimneys on them. Is that what it is?
Not cars.
Oh,
attachment for your chimney.
Like, yeah, so it's just going to be for upper middle class people.
Right, right.
And their chimneys. That worked.
Right, right.
They hadn't been bricked up.
They hadn't been bricked up and had a gas heater installed in them.
Oh, my God.
Russell T. Davis, where does he live?
I genuinely thought it was cars with chimneys and absolutely on board.
I would love it if it was about Eleanor of Aquitaine installing chimneys in all of her castles because she was the first one to do it.
Wow.
Because it was new technology back then and she lived in the south of France in like the 1100s and when she had to go off and be the queen in Paris, she was like, it's freezing here. And if you look at any of her castles where she lived, there's like three fireplaces in the main room.
So that will be in series 13 as well as one of Chibnall's historicals.
Yeah, going to Eleanor of Aquitaine and her amazing interior decorating.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Only the most interesting parts of history visited.
I'll be posting this clip to Vinay Patel.
I love that episode.
And I think the best thing about it is that even though we have this sort of cliffhanger where, in fact, it turns out, oh, well, maybe Wilf is in danger because he's locked in a car with a few fumes. But it does.
But he just gets in there when it starts behaving badly, which is why.
Yeah.
Why?
Because he's going to move it off the street.
Well, he says he's going to move it off the street, but why is it on the street? Anyway.
Yeah.
Surely you don't want to move your poison-emitting car inside.
Wilf's behavior in this episode is very reminiscent of Sylvester McCloy climbing over a cliff to make an actual cliffhanger that doesn't need to happen.
Yeah, yeah, I think that's right. But there is that great final shot. I do think the final shot of the Doctor with his back to us turning around, looking over his shoulder as the smoke sort of swirls in a sort of suburban street.
Completely and defeated, has no idea how to.
It's good. I think that's a nice.
Because he's got a great silhouette.
Yeah.
The tenant in the big coat.
Yeah.
Like it looks good in a smoke-filled street.
And Russell's someone who has said before that one of the important things is to give the Doctor a silhouette.
Yeah. Because he's a cartoonist. Like he draws in very simple shapes.
Yeah.
Like, you know, in his head, I'm sure it's everything is in big, bold colours and big, square, blocky shapes.
Yeah. So it's the opening titles of the Sylvester McCoy era.
Yeah.
But, you know, that sort of super saturated colour palette that you get in the RTD era, a bit more than Moffat.
Mm.
And you can see it in The Next Doctor. There's a scene that's kind of shot like a Torchwood episode. And Russell in the commentary says, no, you know, that's not really our house style for Doctor Who. We have much steadier cameras and much more kind of saturated colours, hence all the purple gems stuff here.
Is that the one they shot in HD but then didn't finish in HD? Because the next one was broadcast in HD. So I reckon they would have been using the HD cameras.
But only.
And then gone, oh, the effects shots have to be SD because they are four times more expensive to render four times higher.
Yeah, that would be right.
And there's a lot of effects in that episode.
And it doesn't go out
in
HD. Planet of the Dead's the first one that
does. Yeah, yeah, yeah. So I reckon they've shot it in HD and been doing all the bells and whistles and tricks. Because you, one of the problems with, I remember like Kev Carlin, who directed Wentworth and Outland, my show, was talking to me when he was doing McLeod's Daughters. They wanted McLeod's Daughters to be done in HD way back when, but it had all the problems of videotape and all of the problems of film, like too much definition and too difficult to fiddle about with. So they just went, let's just shoot McLeod's Daughters on 16mm.
Wow.
And it looks amazing.
Yeah.
You know, I think there are two big problems with Atmos in this episode. One is on a writing level and one's on a production level. I think it's not a functionally dramatic situation having the Atmos, because even before you consider the science of it, people would have to be unconscious for there to be any real damage. And so even though they unleash it at the cliffhanger, it actually takes most of episode two for it to do any harm.
Yeah.
And but so you've got people wandering around it. You've got unit soldiers just standing around. There's the occasional cough. And so the peril is nil.
Except that that's the peril that we experienced this summer. You know, it's gradually going up to 80%. People are being told to stay indoors.
Yeah.
People are avoiding urban areas this where there are cars. And we get these numbers being quoted. You know, it is going to go up to 80%. And it starts to kill people in Tokyo, for instance.
Yeah.
Where so I actually don't mind that, because I think that that threat is more like the threat that it's trying to talk about.
Also, there are older viewers in that audience who would have, as children, experienced the Great Smog.
Oh, the murderous smog that killed the secretary in The Crown.
That's the only episode of The Crown that I've seen.
Isn't that the same smog that Ian ventures out of in Doctor Who and the Daleks novelization? Oil piece super. Well, you see, I think that's good. I mean, that's a good point, although it's a retroactive thing being applied to it. But it's still word peril. We don't see anyone actually in danger.
It's all down to the performances, but Sylvia and Wilf trying to put the towels at the door, and he's puttying the windows, and they're trying to seal the house up, and it's like they make it palpable, those two, because they're such great performers. But no one else in the episode seems to give two hoots. It's like, oh, the cars have gone funny.
I think that scene is so great.
Oh, it's
and
heartbreaking.
I have to think it's Russell, because Sylvia is so prickly and so unlikable, and she's really mean to Wilf and like bosses him around and stuff all the time. But here he calls her my little girl and hugs her while she cries. It's so good.
It's like the old couple on the Titanic who are hugging in the bed. It's like the, you know, when Stephanie Forrester from Bold and the Beautiful has been left by Robert Wagner in the Towering Inferno, like it is. It's just one of those, it's like a disaster movie moment where you just have those tiny little moments to go, well, we're now going to illustrate how terrible it is because we can't show everyone freaking out. Let's show a couple of decent actors freaking out.
Which is really nice. I'm on board with this. But functionally, that is the problem again with the production. Mm. The production should be a wall of fog. It should be it should be the web from the Web of Fear.
Yeah.
It should be something which makes you feel like this is encroaching on their world, whereas actually it just looks like a little bit of mist floating around.
And this is why I think Douglas McKinnon was not a good choice for a director, because like a director with enough nous would go, let's not go outside. Like, I know it's cars, but let's do everything inside with bits of fog and just completely opaque windows.
Well, like in that episode of The Crown, you know, where the fog is really, really thick, really, really oppressive.
Because it's all shut indoors. It's too expensive to put old cars on the street.
Well, that's right. And there are, you know, the news footage thing which they do, which is a thing that I really like in the RTD era. He first does it, doesn't he, in The Second Coming, in order to give it a sort of global scale. And they have a shot of Sydney Harbour and there's a little bit of fog and you kind of think, wow, that would have actually counted as quite a nice day this summer in Sydney.
Oh, man, it's been horrific. But that day that it was raining and still I couldn't breathe because it was smoky, that was the freakiest experience I've ever had.
And the rain was grey.
It was grey rain.
Literally sludge pouring out of the sky.
Well, your car ended up covered in just sort of like dirt.
Yeah.
Like it wasn't even ash. Like there was also dirt from the outback, like the topsoil. And
I was worried that I was going to get chlamydia of the lungs from breathing in all those burnt koalas.
How did you get chlamydia, Adam?
A likely story.
It was the koala. It was smoked koala.
Barbecue koala.
Did anyone notice as well that on that map that UNIT had showing sort of the outbreaks of Atmos, that Papua New Guinea doesn't appear to have any cars?
Well, it's all Kokoda, isn't it? There's no road. It's all
mostly jeeps. Or is that a commentary on the social?
Whether they can't afford Atmos.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Or they've all gone fully electric. They're like way in the future.
Actually, I think it was a modern day iteration of that old classic series trope where you have a needle which is slowly climbing to 100 or whatever and someone's going to blow up. But while it's on screen for 2 seconds, it's clearly covered half of the space it needs to.
Yeah.
How do we ramp up the drama? Push the needle along.
Yeah, shout out a bigger number.
put the needle on it.
Oh, Danny.
Maybe it is only something that works in retrospect, but one of the weird things about watching this Doctor Who from 10 years ago is that they mention climate change kind of over and over again.
You know what is freaking me out is like so at the moment I'm being inundated by La Trolls who are all saying Doctor Who's terrible now. It's just constantly shoving environmental messages down my throat. And I'm like, dude, it's been doing that since the 60s. That's not just a 2020 thing.
No.
Planet of Giants.
Yeah. Planet of Giants.
Planet of the Giants?
The Giants.
Sorry.
Some might say that now is the time. We need to have environmental messages thrust down our throats.
I know, because we've been ignoring them for the last 50 years.
Trolls are very anxious about their throats, though.
Yeah, I know. Someone did. I wrote a tweet the other day saying, you know, being somewhat ironic, saying that when Doctor Who is going to have an environmental message, do we need a trigger warning for the conservative coal-loving snowflakes?
But also, what show have you been watching for the last 56 years?
Also, don't watch science fiction. It's about progressiveness.
Yeah.
Go and watch a Western. They're not progressive at all. They shoot people.
Well, I mean, that's the difference between a sort of science fiction and science sort of fantasy.
Yeah.
Space opera. Sorry.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, Star Wars is not really science fiction.
No, it has knights with swords and dragons. Yeah, yeah. Space dragons.
Yeah. It's a good and evil story, but like because
it's a Western.
Yes.
It's a space Western.
Because of its dominance in our sort of collective
unconsciousness.
Over the last 40 years.
People think that's science fiction.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. No,
I mean, Doctor Who is barely science fiction, but it does do the science fiction thing of using its nonsense to try and address something. Mm. And what we were complaining about last week is a kind of failure to do that last week.
Yeah.
It didn't seem to be about anything. Here it is at least trying to address something. And then the resolution at the end is people stop using their cars and the world's a nicer place. You know, Sylvia's happy for the first time ever and it's because people aren't using their cars and it's lovely outdoors, you know.
But that's not going to last.
Well, I'll revisit that idea in the Forest of the Nights, won't they?
Oh, yes. Oh.
Hooray.
One of the things that I've loved about these two episodes has been the barest mention of the 80s. Donna almost putting a dent in the 80s with the TARDIS. It's like, well, someone did.
maybe that's what caused the UNIT dating.
Well, that, I mean, that's it. He goes, oh, yeah, I worked for UNIT in the 70s or the 80s. It's a bit muddy. Is this Russell trying to gently massage retroactively the bizarre dating that goes on? I mean, you know what? The whole problem is Mordred Undead. That is the...
Yeah.
Which was meant to be Ian, not the Brigadier.
You can tell, can't you? Like, but not that Russell could talk. I mean, his version of Doctor Who was always set 1 year in the future after mid-series one.
But that's what those UNIT things do in the 60s, isn't it? I absolutely don't care because the UNIT stories didn't happen. They were just things on television.
Yes.
And so if they happened at any point, they happened when they were on television.
Yeah.
And, you know, it does a near future thing because it's doing that sort of 60s style spy-fi stuff in the invasion and things. And so I think what Russell's doing is saying, chill the hell out. Yeah. You know, like the 70s, the 80s, I'm playing with you now. It's not going to be ever resolved.
I get that it's a concern to some people.
It's that thing that they did, do you remember, in Star Trek where they talked about the Klingon's appearance changing.
Oh, yes.
Absolutely the best thing possible, which is to have Worf look a bit sheepish and say, we do not like to talk about it. That is all you ever needed, and it was brilliant. But, of course, then in Enterprise, when you had a fan running the show and it was being made for fans, they had to do a whole two-parter all about
what happened to the Mars bars stuck to their head.
The meatloaf.
Which was absolutely terrible.
Imagine what would happen if they ever brought Worf into Picard and had to deal with the the Klingons in Discovery.
That's confronting.
But I think the dent in the 80s is just a reference to Thatcher, surely.
Well, yes, possibly.
Don't you think? I think, or is it the
clothing? The hair.
The hair. Either way.
Those jackets that could turn into a backpack. Smash Hits magazine, whatever it was.
The thing is, and I think this is one of the things that works about this story, and it's probably Russell sort of, and Russell's great with chucking in references to the past without weighing down Doctor Who most of the time. You know, you've got these little sort of in jokes.
The thorax.
Does that one is probably the one that lands the least well.
Yes.
But the whole mispronunciation
of Sontaran.
So great. And we know the backstory, don't we?
Yeah.
So Kevin Lindsay's Australian and Holmes intended it to be pronounced Sontaran.
Yeah.
But he's the one who goes, no, it's Sontaran.
I'm a bloody Sontaran.
I'm from the bloody planet. I should know.
It's funny you say that because we had a reference to Sontarans in Outland, which... So it's just it's Christine Arnoux's character talking about one of the other lesbians because they've had the fight with the lesbians. She's gone, you know her. She looks like Sontaran. But Christine Arnoux kept saying Sontaran, and we have to keep saying, no, it's from Doctor Who. It's Sontaran. So that an Australian pronounced it as Sontaran made me go, how true is this story? Was he laying on the accent when he was living in London going, Sontaran?
He must have.
All of this talk is triggering me with Metabolist 3. So can we talk about the portrayal of UNIT in this story?
Yes.
I think it's meant to look very high-tech and impressive, especially with that first Martha go, go, go scene where the lorries are rolling in. You've got all the soldiers in black with their red berets. And I think by the end of the story, they end up looking as ridiculous and homespun as 70s units.
Yeah. I mean, there's that thing in dialogue about how it's now all very high-tech and it used to be very homespun. But
yes.
I mean, we talked a little bit about this last week, but I'm...
Just getting the truck from International Electromatics from... does not high-tech make.
No.
And then obviously filming it in a building which is three times the size of the truck.
I know, it's weird. They go in the truck and I'm like, have they got TARDIS technology?
I almost thought the sort of watching... a bunch of soldiers directed by Dougie Canfield running around the Guinness factory felt more like a crack international organization. Yes.
Yeah.
Again, I think it's a failure of direction. Like the scenes where they're fighting with the Sontarans and all shooting at one another, it's like occasionally you can see what's going on. I mean, having all the smog there means you can cut down on the number of actors you're shooting at.
Unfortunately, we got the wrong Douglas to direct.
Yeah, that's true. Hmm. Can we also talk about the fact that there was a great opportunity in this story, which is entirely missed, to introduce some new semi-regular characters who would have been really fun to see interact with the Doctor? So you've got basically a Brigadier surrogate. You've got a Sergeant Benton surrogate in Lovely Ross. The Brigadier that they've got in, who is it, Colonel Mace, is that his name?
Yeah, that's his name.
He makes absolutely no impact at all.
No.
Zero.
I would have rather had Bambera back.
Yeah.
And she's not the best actor in the world, but I would have been happy to see her again.
Yeah. Or the character whose name I forget, who shows up first in Turn Left.
Oh, yeah.
Who's brilliant.
Yeah.
She's really good. Is she the one that's in Planet of the Dead?
Yeah.
Why didn't we get her? Or do you think it's because this guy is so ineffectual
that they get someone a little bit
more?
They've
gone, let's get a better.
I mean, it's not a great performance, I have to say, but he doesn't have anything to work with. There's no character there. And you think, surely this should have been one of the driving forces of this script. You're bringing back the return of UNIT. UNIT was about the people.
Yeah.
Have a character who relates to Martha and the Doctor and who you want to spend time with. Mm. Fill it with character rather than plot.
Which is what actually Moffat pulls that off much better.
Oh, much better.
Like, you know, he goes...
And he only has two people in UNIT.
and one of them is absolutely phoning it in.
Yeah.
But because...
but because of who she is, she's phoning it in really quite well.
Yeah. No, I mean, she's absolutely sort of visibly uninterested in what's going on, I think. But that conception of UNIT is great. And then do we add Rebecca Front to UNIT later and various other people?
The Zygon two-parter.
Like it becomes, you know, women, which is kind of pretty cool.
I was frustrated with that Rebecca Front. I get frustrated with a lot of the Moffat guest stars because it's like, and I think it's starting to happen now with Chibnall as well. It's like, we've got this person.
Yeah.
It's like, great.
Give them something to do.
What are we going to... Oh, yeah, there's only two pages for them. And they're all info dumping. It's like David Warner on the submarine.
Yeah, what's that called? Cold War.
Why have you got David Warner? Why have you wasted David Warner on being obsessed with Ultravox?
Like, I actually like that. I'm prepared to pay that.
That's the only good bit in the whole thing. Yeah. It's like, why is he there? Yeah. Like, it's, again, McKinnon.
Yes.
Cold War.
Yeah.
This is the second time we've done this. I mean, Battlefield, for all of the fact that it's maligned, and it's maligned much more than it should be, does what this story does in that it reintroduces a new UNIT. And it manages to populate the story with interesting characters like Bambera,
Zbigniew,
and Pilot Lavelle. You know, people who you actually want to spend time with.
Yeah.
And when Lavelle is killed...
Yeah, it matters.
It's gutting.
Well, because the Brigadier and her have spent something like 3 weeks in a helicopter on the way from sort of London, and so they've really got to know one another.
That is a long helicopter ride.
It really is.
So how could you miss the lesson of Battlefield, which is bring in characters who will relate to your characters? They're ready-made friends for the Doctor. How do you muck that up?
But
I think that was, you know, they've insisted on having Martha, so it's like, well, she's got a character already. Not that they use her in these episodes.
Not so much in these episodes.
And, maybe this is one of the failings of Rayner as a writer, like not creating interesting characters. But equally, I think it's McKinnon as a director, like not understanding how to direct a decent performance. Like, you know, the only time you get interesting characters in this are characters who have been created before. Sylvia, Wilf, Donna.
I mean, Rayner did okay last year with the characters in the Dalek two-parter.
That was one of the things we said, wasn't it, Nathan? That the characters were one of the standout points.
Yeah.
But it may just be because those are not this soldier, this soldier, this soldier, this soldier, but showgirl, you know, poor guy, wise man, you know, like you've got a whole different set of things to do. And then the actors inhabit it.
But maybe part of that is that, you know, she's writing caricatures, not characters. And because you're right, that's this soldier, this soldier, this soldier, this soldier.
How do you differentiate them?
Well, easily. You go like, well, this soldier likes football. That soldier is into cake baking. Like, you know, you just give them character. You yeah. give them things to talk about. But because you've got so many things to tick off your whiteboard checklist, you don't have time for that.
And in fact, there's that kiss between Price and Mace at the very end, which I think is really cool. And the reaction to it is great. They're sort of slightly embarrassed or whatever.
Yeah.
But who cares? Yeah. All she's done is a countdown.
I know.
She's had little...
Corporal Bell had better dialogue back in the...
Oh, Corporal Bell.
Don't we miss the days of Corporal Bell, Mike Yates facing off Corporal against, Bell. You know, three Daleks in Bessie?
you know, apparently Jenkins was named after that line in The Demons.
Oh, yeah.
Sorry, in The Demons? The Demons? How are we going to pronounce that?
Like you do the Latin.
Pertwee changes his mind halfway through the episode.
Yeah. Also, someone was telling me that, like, Latin, like, so there's no agreed pronunciation. Like, I think it might have been even a John Le Carre where it said, like, if depending which private school you went to is how you pronounce things in Latin.
So in the 19th century, people speaking Latin to each other from different European countries couldn't understand one another. But there is a kind of standard pronunciation agreed on here. And when David Tennant says what I would say was Dona Nobis Pacem, he does church Latin version of that.
Oh.
So that's Donna Noble's name was always a Christmas joke, wasn't it, for Runaway Bride? And then it just sort of sticks, but it gets referenced here. And I actually quite like we had reservations about this scene last week because Donna's too scared or something, or too unsure of her own competence. But remember the scene
with the mallet,
the scene where she's talking to the doctor on the phone and going out and disabling the teleport or whatever, or re-enabling it.
I think part of the problem with that scene, like, yes, she should have more agency and she shouldn't be that scared, but on paper and in and what has been verbal in this episode is that the Sontarans are an absolutely ruthless, terrifying race of people.
Yeah.
Like, the Doctor has been on about that. Like, you can't kill them with bullets. You can't shoot nuclear weapons at them. They are the most vicious fighters in the universe. So that's been said, but it's all been tell, don't show,
which is
a sin in television.
It's word peril.
We haven't seen them do anything other than throw shade at a teenager that runs a website. That's been the worst thing they did last week.
Well, they did shoot two guys in the leg. But
in
it is
leg.
Exactly the opposite of what they're supposed to be.
Yeah, they should be horrific, you know, martial creatures. And they're so, like, writing-wise, of course she should be more reticent than anything else she's done.
Yeah.
But because we haven't seen anything, any evidence of their horrific behavior, it feels unsatisfying that she's not prepared to go out there, but she's been told.
Yeah.
Well, absolutely. But also, there is one scene, I think, in this episode where it is quite nasty, and it's the scene where the unit soldiers are massacred, and that's a setup for later on when they fight back. But it really is quite nasty. You see a lot of people screaming and dying, and that's unusual for Russell's Doctor Who.
Yeah. Oh, just unusual for unit in general, because unit episodes, generally, no one can shoot straight.
Yeah.
On either side.
No.
But that would have worked if Donna had been in those scenes experienced those scenes. But there's a disconnect there. Like, she's heard a lot, but she hasn't seen it. If she had witnessed these people being massacred, her fear would have been justified.
Mm. What if also she'd seen Ross die firsthand?
Yeah. Mm.
Also, the internal logic of the episode is bad because it starts with her flying the TARDIS. It's like, oh, I'm good at this now.
Yeah.
And then it ends with her being afraid to leave the TARDIS. Yeah. And you're like, well, you've written yourself in a circle there.
So clearly the flying the TARDIS thing is added. I'm saying that's Russell and that it's part of the ongoing arc to make the Doctor and Donna the same.
Yeah.
And so it is just there for that reason, don't you think? And you have the Doctor saying, I can't believe you're doing this. That plot with Donna, I think, gets maybe 2 points. And one is the phone call when she calls Wilf and Sylvia. And Sylvia's first instinct is to put her down, you know, accuse her of being too smart and all of that. And then she catches herself and it's like a proper supportive phone call. But her first instinct is to be nasty to Donna. And I think that characterization and giving Donna that relationship with her mother is another part of like recreating her character to be something interesting enough to hold 13 episodes.
Do you think there's a contrast? It's not particularly well drawn, but there's contrast there between the Doctor building Donna up. You can do this. You can fly the TARDIS. Yeah. You're brilliant. And then she speaks to her mum and her mum brings her back down again.
I think that's good. And then I do think the other one is just that bit at the end where she says, they've seen me, and just her performance there, I think is really good.
I'm very excited. You know, the Big Finish are doing a Donna box set. I want to know when Big Finish are going to do a box set about the American Newsreader, because she's in so many of these Russell T. Davis episodes. She should have her own box set, surely.
Trinity Wells Reports.
Yes.
Just say it twice more, James, and you'll get it.
Do you want me to?
No.
How about we have a unit box set with our unit characters from this story? Oh, and please listen to that. Can you imagine? You don't even have to watch. Just listen.
What was that thing that Josh Snares posted the other day?
He wanted a box set of
Martha and Malfa from...
And apparently Martha is doing a box set. I know, I saw there was a thing the other day. You know how they find these things out because idiots put it on their CV months before. And yeah, someone is in the Toclophane stories.
Oh,
it's going to be all about Martha wandering the world, telling her story. I mean, there have been four books of that. Yeah, now they're going to...
Yeah. And that's a well that could probably work quite well going to...
Yeah.
In audio.
Yeah.
And look, I mean, I love Freema.
She's great.
She's not well used this season.
No.
But she was great in Series 3. She has had a very successful career since.
Mm. She's a good actor.
Mm.
And you know, that might be at the heart of the biggest disappointment about this story is that Martha is really good. And Martha was important to the audience. And then she's brought back and laid low. Mm. They don't do a lot with her.
I mean, as much as I hate the storyline with Faux Martha pressing the button over and over, that scene where she talks to herself is glorious. Like, technically, that is a difficult scene to play because you are talking to someone who's not there. Like, you can't even play off the person. Like, it's a stand-in, obviously. But she plays both of those characters in such distinctly different ways that you do go... Oh, this clone Martha is sad at what she's had to do and the life that she's been given. And the other Martha is like, it is a really beautiful, beautiful moment. And you get to see Freema Agyeman doing something that she's not been allowed to do in the whole rest of her time on the show, which is act.
Yeah. She'll get kind of acting moments next week, but they'll be stupid.
Yeah.
So you have to think that scene is kind of let's give Freema something, you know, like something to do.
I mean, the fact that, you know, I mean, you're going to talk about this next week, but the fact that she manages to carry half an episode talking to a bubble machine is incredible. Like anyone else could have made that as stupid as it looks, but she endows it with a lot more gravitas than it actually needs. Same as when she's being shot off into the sun.
Yeah.
But in 42, like she's so good in that episode that you're just like, this could have been the worst thing that ever happened in this show. And she drags it back down to a level that it is not as dumb as it looks.
Yeah. But I have to think that someone on the production team hates her because here she's like covered in KY. Next week she's flailing about in mud. She's got aging makeup on Torchwood this season. Like she really, it's
you know what?
Very
it's not that anyone hates her. It's because they know she can do it. Like I'm friends with Kimberly Cooper who used to be on Home and Away. And she went through a period where I think she was a lesbian. She was possibly raped and held by terrorists, like all within the space of about 8 weeks. And I was like, why do they keep making you do this? And she's like, because the other riches can't. It's like they write a storyline for, say, you know, Beck Cartwright and Nee Hewitt. and then they go, oh, she actually can't do this. Mm. And whereas with Freema, it's like, yeah, let's put her through the ringer because she can do it.
Yeah.
Like, we can trust her to do this. Like, she's a decent actor and we can just throw anything at her. And she's like, yep.
Yep. Mud, I'm in.
I'm in. I can do mud.
Let's not forget the greatest indignity foisted upon her wearing that brown jacket for episodes on end.
Oh, I love that jacket. Can we talk about another fine acting performance? Luke. Everyone hates Luke, don't they? Are Brannigan. They right? Yeah. Is it Luke Brannigan?
Did you say Brannigan?
Yeah. Rattigan.
No, I call him Brattigan.
Brattigan. Oh,
because he's like a 12-year-old.
I keep wanting to call him Terrence for some reason. It's the playwright.
Oh, yeah. Terrence Rattigan. Well, Rattigan's like a recycled name because that was the original name of the Foster from the
Miss
first Foster. Episode.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Okay. She was originally Miss Rattigan. Well, in the script, she was Miss Rattigan.
Right.
It's a pointless character. It's a thoughtless performance. It's like why the Sontarans were even, you know, lowering themselves to spend time with him, let alone join in whatever this mysterious plan is.
And so he has a chip on his shoulder because he's very smart and people are mean to him. And it causes him to behave in a way that is just absolutely incomprehensible.
Oh, my God. The running terrible joke about the Atmos system. It can't be system because the S stands for system.
It's like
people who go crazy about the ATM machine.
Yeah.
And I wrote a thing for Hard Quiz about DC Comics because DC stands for Detective Comics. So it's right, basically Detective Comics comics.
And in fact, it's just a normal thing that happens in English all the time.
Yes.
But it's also like David Tennant correcting his use of was instead of were, which as far as I'm concerned is perfectly reasonable English and shut up.
Yeah.
I get the point of that scene, but it's kind of witless the way it's done.
Well, yeah. But
it's a script written by a script editor.
Yeah.
So, of course, it's about, I'm going to write a scene about all the things I've had to correct from all these scripts over the years. Oh, my Lord, the things that are in these scripts are terrible.
It's the thing where you mistake levels of formality for correctness and incorrectness. It just annoys me enormously. And the script itself makes it clear that his reaction is stupid because he surrounded himself by geniuses.
Attractive geniuses.
Yes.
In red tracksuit to attractive red, geniuses.
Yeah, yeah. This weird cult that he's made up.
He thinks that they're going to be Ruth and Adam in Invasion of the Dinosaurs.
Yeah, it's a far better story.
So. I know. Like the Golden Dawn thing is fascinating, but what is he doing?
No, so he thinks that they're going to stand there and watch their families all suffocate and then happily go off with him to join his carefully worked out breeding program. And like, it's not really played for laughs or anything like that. It's super weird.
Yeah.
And what's with this breeding program? He's evidently gay.
He's breeding them.
There's a strange lapse of logic here because in the first episode, first scene, when they're throwing out that journalist, they look brainwashed or something. They look like his private army. They don't have any emotion on their faces. And yet in this episode, they just look like normal people who've been standing at their benches in a laboratory developing ion drives or whatever. And
they don't even get their own laboratories. They're all just at adjacent tables.
Yeah. Some of them have got test tubes on. That's fine, yeah. But suddenly they're real people going, what the hell are you doing? And the two don't mesh up.
No. I mean, it's almost, again, I'm gonna blame a director who goes, oh, yeah, there's hypnotized people in this episode, so you're all hypnotized. Like not having read the entire script or not having it in his... Because part of a director's job is to know the entire script backwards and forwards and to know how one scene relates to another, even if you're filming completely out of order. So he should know that these are not the same hypnotized people as work at the factory. But maybe that wasn't spelled out enough in the script.
So he's the Peter Moffat of the 21st century.
Well, he does go on to direct things like Listen.
Again... The monster popping up from the bed. How was that an imaginary monster? Let's not talk about
this. I think Rattigan is a difficult character to get on board with because no one likes a boy genius. No, no one learned the Wesley Crusher lesson.
The Adric lesson.
Adric.
Yeah, well, absolutely.
Oh, my God, he's Adric.
He's sort of smug and he's ratty.
Why is he American?
Do you think it's just startup culture? Like, it's kind of like he invented a search engine, so he's American for some reason.
But
he's
why? Got a why can't? Bay Area why wouldn't thing. You?
Yeah.
Why has he gone to England?
Yeah.
Like, he, that guy's not American, is he? No. He's British.
No.
He's doing an accent.
Yeah.
Not well.
No. Well, you know who he is. He's the fictional forerunner to that guy, Martin Shkreli, I think his name was.
Yeah,
who
yeah.
took over the company and, like, which made a toxoplasmosis drug and then hiked up the price yes. by 1,500% or something and said, well, my investors expect a return, and was basically the most hated man
in
the
country. And he was the one
forever.
Who bought the Wu-Tang Clan album that yes. there's only one yes. copy of. Yes, yep. yes.
Is he in jail now?
He's in jail now. He's
hooray.
Jail.
Yay.
so he was someone who was smug and annoying and ratty-faced and, you know, thought that they were better than everybody else. And so that is the kind of character we're going for here. However, having said that, I remember not being particularly sold on Ryan Sampson's performance, and I am now.
Oh, really?
I think he is doing by far the best job you could do with that character.
Yeah,
it's he's annoying and he's abrasive and he's vulnerable, and it is a weird choice of accent, but I quite like it because it makes the character more annoying. And I think no one could have done better with that character.
But it does feel like we said last week when it's like a Sarah Jane Adventures
yeah.
character, like it's too broad.
Yeah, but I think sometimes some of the underplaying that we get elsewhere, some of the forgettable characters elsewhere in this story, that's a worse sin, I think, than what Radican does, probably.
Yeah, I think the story would be much worse off without his performance because he brings
again,
some much-needed colour.
A failure of direction. It's like he should have been reined in. Some of the others should have been encouraged to, you know, jump in with both feet, and it's instead we just get this weird... Oh, yeah, whatever you're doing on the day will be fine. Yeah.
I think if he was reined in, then he would completely disappear in the scenes against David Tennant.
Yeah.
But surely he's having a competition with Chris Ryan.
Chris Ryan and David Tennant.
Yeah.
I'm surprised there's any scenery left.
Well, you see, I actually don't think he's that over the top. I really don't. I think he's doing what the character is calling for him to do, which is a big ask of any actor. Yeah. But I think he's actually pitching those scenes quite well, because a defining aspect of this character is meant to be that he thinks he's cleverer than anyone else and gets extremely agitated if someone points out that he's not. So when things start to get away from his control, he just becomes a petulant child. I'm not sure that was a great idea at the scripting stage, but you can't put it on Ryan. I think he does it well.
Mm. Yeah.
And also, he's in Plebs as Grumio, and he is fantastic.
He's so really he good in all He's in a couple of big out. Finishes, and he's really good in those.
He's great at comedy.
Yeah. He's a good actor. Mm. It's just this is a thankless, as you say, a thankless role, and it's a nightmare of a character. It's just not like he's too annoying to be like, this is the thing that annoys me in this episode is like everyone is painted in such broad strokes that we get nothing.
I think it was a strange character to go for at the conceptual stage. Maybe something better would have been a Donald Trump Jr.
Yeah.
You need someone who's got militaristic, entitled tendencies who would see something like the Sontarans as a key to power.
Yeah, yeah. But like a venture capitalist.
Listen to this, Donald Trump Jr.
But
don't
also,
sue me.
He is very rarely linked to the factory. Like, I don't see. Like, the unit go to the factory to investigate this machine, which supposedly has something to do with him. He maybe invented it. Who knows? But we never get that connection. Like, we never have the what ties them together apart from that scene with the journalist right at the start.
Yeah.
And then we never hear from him being involved at all. Next thing, he's trying to go to another planet and he's hanging out with some tyrants.
There's a single line from General Stahl about, we only needed you for the Atmos technology. Yeah. That's it. That's like literally the script just ties them together by going, yeah, he created this thing and they used him.
Yeah.
And you know, that collection of geniuses that were going to another planet, the Sontarans just expected to just shoot them all on arrival. So what even is that? Like, what's going on here?
It's listen to how evil we are. We're not going to do anything evil, but listen to how evil we're thinking of being.
but also, given they're supposed to be sort of honourable in battle, how is that honourable in battle to shoot
Oh no,
there's so many mentions of them being dishonorable Sontarans in this. Yeah. Like, I feel like now this is a big Finnish story we need to do is this dishonorable bunch of Sontarans who've split up from the main faction and they're being chased around the universe for being not properly Sontaran. Mm. There was a flaw in their cloning. It made them sly.
All right, it's the second episode of a two-parter, and that means picks of the week. So, James, do you have something for us?
Yeah, so my pick of the week I think it's probably one of the better, cleverer comedies that the BBC has made in the last 10 or so years. It's a Jessica Hines created, written, and starring.
Whoa.
Comedy.
Is it spaced?
No.
She was still Stevenson.
It was on BBC Four.
Okay.
And it's Up the Women.
Oh, okay.
Which takes the women's suffrage movement and makes it into quite a sort of witty little comedy.
Get out.
And it has Ryan Sampson in it playing a very effete sort of suitor to one of the young ladies. And it's just fantastic. It also has Rebecca Front in it. And she's Nikki Pepperdine. Find it and watch it. They only lasted 9 episodes. They made a 3-episode first season, a 6-episode second season.
And then that was it. That's what they do in England generally. Mm. Like, that's Doctor Who is an outlier, really, like, for doing more than 4 episodes.
Yeah. And most drama is no more than 6.
Yeah.
Maybe it should have ended at episode 13. Oh, Doctor Who. How about that?
No.
We would have finished this by now.
Yeah, but you'd be done.
Adam, do you have a pick of the week?
I watched a thing on Netflix called The Stranger, ooh, which is based on a Harlan Coben book.
Not to be confused with The Stranger, which is on iView at the moment.
Yeah, the old Australian tilted Doctor Who.
No. Also or not to be confused with Bill Bagg's The Stranger.
The Colin Baker version.
I know, it's a handy title to have. produced by Nicholas Schindler, who is the Red production company who have done like Years and Years, Queer as Folk, all that kind of thing. And I feel like Netflix have contacted her and gone, we want to do a Broadchurch. And so it like they have thrown some money at actors. It's Richard Armitage, Hannah John Kamen, is that her name? You know, from the Wasp and the Ant-Man. she's the Stranger. Jennifer Saunders is in it.
Oh, God.
Me over at that.
Mrs. O'Brien from Down. The Morax. Like, it is just like, Sean Dooley is in it. Like, it is just a roll call of amazing British actors.
This sounds wonderful. How have I not heard of this?
And it is, like, I think it's 8 episodes. And each one, the end of each episode is like the end of an episode of Broadchurch where you're like, no, how did that? I have to watch the next one. And then you'll get to the end and you'll be like, if this was an American show, I would have called bullshit 4 episodes ago because there are too many coincidences, too many things that tie into each other. And you're like, how is this not, like, that was a plot hole and now that, like, but it is, because it's British, it is so compelling. Anthony Head is in it. Oh, God. Like, you just get to the end of it and you're like, that was terrible and amazing all at the same time. I love it. It is a proper binge watch show. Like, you can't stop watching once you got to the end of it. You're like, oh, I don't want to watch the next one. I had a conversation with a writer recently about why am I reticent to watch a movie, but I will happily watch 8 episodes of a TV show. And she goes, because a TV show doesn't ask you for 2.5 hours.
Yeah.
A TV show only asks you for an hour. If you choose to spend another hour, that's your choice. And then another hour, and then another hour.
Which is why you only get, what is it, like 7 seconds before a streaming service
flips over to the next episode? Oh, no, I've turned that off on all of them.
Oh, okay.
I've turned, like, I have to consciously press the button to go on to the next one. Like, it's my choice to go on to the next one. Like, I can't deal with skipping ahead and missing the credits. I love an opening credits.
I've lost whole weekends to that.
I'm not sure that model fits all. I mean, there's an episode coming up next week of Doctor Who, which I think asks for 2.5 hours.
And it's only 50 minutes long.
And has some very questionable...
everything.
Human relations behind the scenes.
So, Peter.
My picks of the week are going to be short and sweet. One is the horror Fang Rock.
Yay.
That fan favourite, because you know that if Russell had stayed for 15 series, then the Rutans would have been the big comeback in the early two-parter. Maybe we got one this week with Colonel Mace. I'm not entirely sure. He stuck with his half-Rutan.
I thought when Jodie Whittaker ran up to the lighthouse the other day, there was going to be a route on it.
I was thinking maybe it would be, I could recommend Elite, which is a Spanish school-based series on Netflix where you go behind the scenes of this very rich and impressive academy, and it's filled with lots of beautiful people with lots of machinations and sex. And I mean, how would that have improved the Ratican Academy? Oh, I don't know.
Yeah, more banging.
not with Luke Ratigan.
No, he's not unpretty.
No. So my pick of the week is Armando Iannucci's new show, which is called Avenue 5. It stars Hugh Laurie and it has Rebecca Front in it, which we were required to mention her. Yep, she's fabulous.
Tragically applied.
Yep. And you know how Star Trek is kind of very 60s. It's this sort of great liberal project. It's sort of multicultural. We're out to explore the stars and stuff. It's got a very sort of Kennedy era vibe. This has a very kind of 2020 vibe where everything's being run by absolute morons and there's a massive disaster that a sort of galaxy accident that we can't agree on and all sorts of things. And so it is... you know, the TV show starring a bunch of people on a spaceship that is made for us now in 2020.
I do love the Americans make utopian science fiction and the Brits make dystopian science fiction.
Yeah. Why is it called Avenue 5?
It's the name of the ship, but I don't know why. I don't know. Is it a Fifth Avenue reference or something? There are critiques of capitalism in it, obviously, because of course there are
someone on Fifth Avenue. And
yeah. I'm not quite sure. Maybe I'll find out. But it's very good. And if you like Iannucci, and of course you do, I can suggest definitely checking it out.
Well, there we go. I'm there for two new series this week.
Brilliant.
Don't hate me for The Stranger. It is wonderful and terrible all at the same time.
Listener, that's all we've got time for this week. The TARDIS is completely out of control, but we're sure we'll be back next week in time to watch a fish drown in the Doctor's daughter. In the meantime, you can find us wherever you get your podcasts, and you can keep up with us at Flight Through Entirety on Facebook, at FTE Podcast on Twitter, and on our website, flightthroughentirety.com, where you'll find links to our other podcasts, Bonfinger and Jodie into Terror. Adam, where can people find you?
At Adam Richard on Twitter and Instagram, Fabulous Adam Richard on Facebook, adamrichard.com.au.
Until next time, maybe leave the car at home. Remember that when the levels reach 80% density, we're all going to die. Thank you very much for listening and good night.
Good night.
Good night.
Good night.
That was Flight Through Entirety, starring Nathan Bottomley, Peter Griffiths, Adam Richard and James Selwood. Theme arrangement by Cameron Lamb, strings performance by Jane Orberg. This episode, This Soldier, This Soldier, This Soldier, This Soldier, was recorded on the 8th of February 2020 and released on the 12th of April. Here at FTE, we'd like to apologise that the two-month lag between recording and release means that for most of this series, we are at least one global apocalypse behind. We hope at least that you enjoy the break. I'm Nathan.
I'm James.
I'm Adam. Peter. Oh, what?
No, I'm Peter.
Oh, I thought Let's I was third.
You're the guest.
No, you're the guest. You're Adam Richard.
I was just going clockwise. I was going clockwise. No one can see the room.
All right. Let's do it again. I'm Nathan.
I'm James.
I'm Adam.
And I'm not. Oh, no, but I am.
I think we just go with that. All right, I've dropped the recorder.
So who are you again?
Peter.
Well, we've been stuck in this Peugeot 307 for a week.